people tend to grab everything immediately. You start your meeting, apparently we no longer allow us to take our stuff in so that we continue to nibble as we progress. So if you'll need anything extra later, just get it now. All right. We're going to proceed from where we left last week. We're discussing the stretch plan. And as you know, the issues flow from strat plan for which decision is required from us. We'll get to those things. There is going to be a need after the presentation and engagement for us to discuss the programs going forward. We'll try and finish early enough to allow that discussion before everybody rushes off to catch their plane. I understand that the bit that's left is not much. I think much is going to be more on the engagement. So without wasting any further ado, let me allow the AG to proceed from where they left. Last week there was a lot of interruptions and interjections from our side because we were also trying to clarify things, having dealt with them for the first time now. But going forward now, we are going to allow them to flow with their presentation and interrupt it. And then at the end, we would then begin to engage with and interact with them. Over to you, AJ.
Thank you, Chair. What we'll need to do is just to finalize the discussion on the strategic document itself and just reflect on the whatever remaining information needed to be presented and then round it up by reflecting on how at an organizational level we intend to monitor and measure the manner with which we live up to the five promises that we have put in front of you as a committee. Because there are other measures in the detailed document which will help us to look at things at a at an operational level. But there also are measures that we would like to share with you that will help us to look at these issues at more of an output or outcome level. And those measures we have not as yet shared with you and link them directly to the broad, high-level, organizational performance imperative. So we will do that and then we'll move on to the tariff and then move on to the directive, all of which will be discussed on the basis of the detailed documents that you shall have had with yourselves, but we'll simply just give a broad overview of the intent of each document and the fundamental principles and assumptions that underpin the contents of each of the two important documents, which SCOWEC will have to approve. Yeah. But then that said, I'll wrap up the detailed strategic plan. Just give me a go through that.
Thank you very much, AG. Thank you, Chair. The meeting, the last time we met, we took the committee through the five areas of commitment that we have positioned in our strategic plan. We've also reported on the outcomes for the year ending March 2009 and covering largely those five areas. And after the presentation last week and having passed on the detailed document outlining our specific plans and specific activities that we propose to focus on with regard to the 2010 to 2013 period. We felt that at least members of the committee would have had an opportunity to read through all of that detail, maybe having also gone through the same issues when we went about the orientation right up to last week. We thought maybe the one way to wrap it up today is to focus on what is it that we propose should then be measured in order to get the committee to assess whether we are moving in the right direction over the next period, 2010 to 2013. And what we basically put together today, without having to go through the detail of what's in the narrative in the document, we will position the proposed measures over the next 3 years that we think will give a sense of progress in respect of each one of the 5 goals. But to lay it all off, firstly is to start with the first overall objective that the office exists for, and that is to, among others, ensure that we build public confidence. And we said that the one way that that ultimate outcome is going to be achieved is if the office begins to meet its objective of influencing the achievement of clean audits. And we think that that is achievable because we have positioned in our strategy plan a number of interventions, both with the legislature as well as with the members of the executive and many other role players, to make sure that we are at all times engaging them on the need to put in place what is required to achieve clean audits. Now, our view is that this initiative of clean audits, obviously, we would need to be measuring this with a view to tracking the impact that is coming through in the system. It's not one of the things that we want us, in our respective roles in the organization, to be measured on. Because while we are busy signing off audit opinions, we do not want to be measured on the outcome of clean audits, because there may well be a challenge with respect to the fact that if you are going to be internally measured on your own performance, on the outcome of audits that you yourself are expressing an opinion on, it may put you in a conflicting situation in some ways. So we are saying that 2010 to 2011, our desire is that all the things that we do with respect to visibility of leadership, with respect to a strengthened human resource base in the organization, our own leading by example in terms of our clean environment in the organization, as well as the resources that we get from the fees that we raise. If we can do all those things well, we think that we can target the achievement of clean audit opinions to the extent of 60%, rising over the next 2 years up to 100% by 2013. All of those things that we do happen as we propose, we would be positioning ourselves to have a progressive increase in the number of audit opinions within the environment of the PFMA as well as the environment of the MFMA. And we've taken this from the current base that we have. And clearly, if one looks at the audit outcomes up to the end of this year, they are pretty much, for example, under the PFMA, we are currently sitting at about almost 25% of what we call clean, as it were. And that's definitely going to be a major push on our part to say the fruition of our initiatives should at least get us closer to 60%. The same vein within the municipalities environment. I think all of us have seen over time the number of challenges within this sector. And that's why that the base that is set is lower than what the PFMA target will be. So that's overall what we will try and achieve come 2010 going forward. Those are the targets with regard to the outcomes of clean audit opinions. To do this, as we said at the last engagement, we would also need to ensure that we continue to identify the root causes of all the outcomes that are impacting on the environment and be able to recommend actions that need to be taken to our report. And that's what the issue of visibility, or rather the simplicity and relevance of our message. And this is to do with our internal initiatives in the organization, the regular engagement with our stakeholders, the focus around determining for the executive and the legislatures what actions they need to be focusing on in order to ensure that there will be an ultimate outcome of clean audits. So that's the simplicity target that we're putting in place. And in terms of the weight of our effort, we've clearly positioned the area of our product element at an overall weighting of 40% of our overall efforts. And part of it is under the ultimate outcome of audit opinions, but we're putting a lot of emphasis on writing the reports in a manner that can be understandable to the users of those reports. And if I go through to the next one on the visibility of our leadership, and this runs right across the whole organization, and it's about building professional relationships that are driven by our understanding of the audit mandate to make sure that we can influence ultimately the people that will be doing the work within the institutions that we audit are the finance officers, the involvement of people who are in the executive within those institutions. And we believe that if we can continuously engage them on all the issues that require action, that influence should at least trigger an outcome that will translate to clean audit opinions. And we are putting a lot of emphasis in our threat plan going forward on the issue of our visibility, both in terms of our internal stakeholders, which include staff, as well as the external stakeholders, which include parliament, executive, and the administrative functionaries in the whole three spheres of government. In terms of the funding resources, as we explained when articulating the background and the essence of the funding model, we have pegged, if you look at our results over the last 3 years at least, we have been operating at a net deficit. And after we've implemented from the financial year beginning 1 April 2009, where we implemented our new revised funding model, where we increased the tariffs by some large percentages, we think that we can commit to a target of net surplus come 2010 onwards that will be hovering around 5% and 6% of our net revenue. We haven't operated at this level before. It's a hard ask, but we believe that we have aligned our resources and our tariff regime to the extent that our budgets would possibly be able to generate these levels of surplus. And I think it is after these surpluses have been realized that we will then have to have an engagement with the committee as what then must happen to those surpluses. These are not big surpluses, but we believe that they are the type that will continue to help sustain the needs of the Auditor General over the next while. It will require us to ensure that we upgrade and increase the replacement of our fixed assets, among others, and we will obviously not use this surplus without having engaged at the time of going through the annual report with the committee. So those are the targets that we have set ourselves in terms of this. It will require a lot of cost containment processes to be implemented regularly on our side, but at the same time, we also want to make sure that we do not unnecessarily increase the cost of auditing to government. So we've looked at this in the context of what are the year-on-year average increases in terms of the cost of auditing, as well as also taking out certain excess elements of cost that might be sitting in our environment. So those are the assumptions we've built around achieving that target of net surplus. Insofar as the human resource element is concerned, it also becomes very critical because the more people we retain in the organization over a long term, the less cost we spend on retraining and reintroducing people to our methodology of auditing. Now, this target that is set here is to say that the retention levels, particularly at supervisory and management levels, need to be in the high of 80% going up over the next couple of years so that we can be able to reap the benefits of the investment that we put into the training of trainee accountants as well as the growth internally of our own trainee accountants to become managers and supervisors. And that, I think, over a period of time, once they accumulate this institutional knowledge,
they will add to that overall objective of trying to get to clean audits, because they will be understanding the history and understanding the approach and the context within which the Auditor General operates. And the last goal, which is the one dealing with our own internal operations, which deals with our setting a standard of excellence internally in the organization, whereby we say that the issue around annotations to our audit reports over the next while, we are not going to settle for anything like that. As members have seen in the annual report that we presented what we refer to as a clean audit report, a report where there is no qualification and there are no other matters that are of concern to the auditors. And that's what we are saying we will gear our resources towards, so that before we get out and preach the gospel of trying to achieve clean audits, at least we start on a clean slate in our own internal environment. And this area we'll obviously cover, including leading by example on matters pertaining to the transformation of the environment in which we operate. And we've taken on board the need to contribute to the transformation of the profession in general. And that is achieved, among others, through allocation of work via the contract work regime that we have, so that we can strive for a balance to promote some of the emerging accounting firms who are interested in auditing on our behalf. I think let me leave it at that, Chair. I think those are the five key goal areas that we have put targets for ourselves, and I will probably take some questions on this if they are ready. Thank you.
The last slide, how does it relate? Are we, what's your presentation, the last part of your presentation relating to the last slide? Hello? Were the slides running behind? Yeah. Talking about the last part of it.
Yeah. It's part of the chair. It's part of it. That bit that I left out, which talks about adherence to all quality standards and compliance with statutory and regulatory deadlines, that is part of what is in the first goal, effectively. So then, under the first goal, in terms of simplicity, relevance, and clarity of message, we have also incorporated the angle that deals with adherence to all quality standards. And here, this target for quality standards is pegged at a level that is consistent with what we've achieved thus far. If members recall, I think we were hovering around 90%, but we believe that that target of 90% was quite a huge number to achieve. And we believe that in the nature of the work that we do, there may well be situations where we need to accommodate the fact that there will be one or two people in our system who may not meet those quality standards. So that's where the percentage for the quality comes from, but it's part and parcel of goal one. It's not a separate goal. And also the issue of timeliness, which is the compliance with statutory and legislative deadlines. If these deadlines are achieved by the system to the extent of 90% and above, it will enable us to have an accurate analysis as part of our root cause analysis under the first chapter.
All right, I think we're at a point where we will be opening up for interaction with this presentation, and I invite members to come forward, first Dr. George and then Honorable Steele.
Thank you, Chairperson. On page number one, where you're talking about influencing the achievement of clean audits. Now, obviously, an objective needs to be measurable, or, you know, clearly measurable, you know, either you do or you don't. And I think the question is just how much, I know there's certain things that you do during the audit process and, you know, influence the various people that are involved to do the right thing and so on. But if you look at influencing it, you can either influence it and then have some kind of consequence if people don't do the things you want them to do, or it seems a bit nebulous to me somehow. You know, I mean, so if you do, advise the various parties and give them good guidelines and whatever the case is and, you know, all of that, but they still don't actually get a clean audit. I don't know if that's under your control. And if it isn't, then you shouldn't be measuring yourself on that way. I think you can only measure something that you actually have control over. So, for example, if, say, you make suggestions or, you know, guidelines, whatever, and they're not followed, and there can be action, then I think it makes a bit more sense. But I'm just wondering whether you're not going to set yourself up for a beating on that one. And then on the issue of the surplus on page number 3, you know, I think certainly your sentiment is the right one, efficiently and effectively. I'm just wondering if you need to target a surplus, because at the end of the day you do have a budget, and hopefully you're not padding the budget. So, you know, is that really the right target? Shouldn't you rather be sort of meeting the budget effectively rather than trying to make some money? I don't know if that is the right objective. Thanks, Jay.
Thanks, Chair. Yeah, my concern is largely covered. I just don't think it's a good idea to put an objective for something, quite frankly, which you can't control. Otherwise, you're going to be held accountable, or the AG's office is going to be held accountable for factors, for individuals, for policies, for structures, whatever, which actually lie within the accounting offices of the different departments, not within the AG's office. So I just think that's a dangerous area to go into. I don't think that there's a problem with striving for increased clean audits. Obviously, that's the objective of all of us. But for the AG's office to make it their target in quite this way, I think without qualification, it's very dangerous.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I think the Deputy IG on page 1, on the simplicity, clarity, and relevance of the message, on the initiative, he added by saying, obviously, there will be recommendation on actions to be taken. My question would be, that currently, in regards to the code of conduct of public servants, that they need to declare their interest in business operations, but this is not happening. Where do you think the problem lies? I think as a committee responsible also for oversight and as members of parliament deals with legislation, maybe the weakness might be on the same legislation, maybe the same PSMA or MSA. Are there any weaknesses around those two documents that they might recommend? Because obviously it's there on a paper, but it's not implemented by civil servants. And the other issue is on funding model. Do you have a debt recovery plan? Because earlier on in your presentation, you always say most of the departments or institutions still hold it. Do you have a recovery plan?
Professor Dalagala. Thank you, Honorable Chair. Mine is a comment and a small question. Now, the concept lead by example on page 3 is exciting, and in my view, a concept that can motivate other organizations and departments. I know it is not your responsibility to influence departments directly, but what measures would you suggest to be followed to positively influence other departments so that they can also imitate you and lead by example?
Any other hand? Honorable for people?
Maybe. Thank you.
it's on page 1. The DAG said they would be identify the root causes. What I would like to know is that because there are these departments that are doing very bad, up until now, were there, if they, there were some routes that they will find out from these people, wouldn't they already find out? Are they still going to identify them, or the, what is going to happen there? What mechanism are they going to apply in this, in this matter? Thank you.
I suppose there's a document called Agenda for Today. Is this how we are proceeding today in terms of the items that we're going to be dealing with? I just want to correct one small thing there. It says B in brackets by Mark Steele. I think whoever wrote that should make an adjustment. It should be Honorable Mark Steele. But obviously, if there are issues that have been raised that will be elaborated upon in the subsequent presentations, you can make that indication. I wanted to touch on the issues that are raised both by Dr. George and Honorable Steele, and that is the which I think actually go to, it's a back to basics question. It goes back to the core mandate of the key role player. Whose responsibility is it to do what, which we touched on last week in the broad scheme of things around achieving full accountability. I as the DAG was presenting, almost interrupted and said, could it be a contradiction in terms? But then I thought, maybe it's not. Because he himself did further say that it's not up to them to ensure that there is clean audit. Ultimately, it's up to the auditee to ensure that they do the things that they are required to do so that there is a clean audit. There's a saying in English that you can take a horse or a donkey, or the horse, all right, to the river, but you can't make it drink. But my teacher once taught me that you can actually make the horse to drink, and I don't know how, whether there are any horse riders or horse keepers here. He says you can block its nostrils and push its mouth into the water. In an attempt to breathe, it will actually drink. That's on a lighter note. But I think that maybe what the DAG then needs to do is to come back and explain that dialectic, if you like, because it really is a dialectic. Because I think, in fact, maybe there's a specific reason why they use the term influence. Maybe it is a loaded term that they need to unload. But yeah, let's tackle that issue first. And see if we can have a further engagement, because it goes to the core of the mandate as to what is your role, what is the auditee's role, what is our role, possibly what is the executive's role in terms of oversight.
Thanks very much, Chair.
I think it's a very important matter. We've raised it again when we debated whether we should have this as a measure, and we agreed in the office among ourselves that in fact we cannot be measured on this because we do not have control over it. We agree on that. I think what we're doing here, we are basically putting it on the radar so that all of these other initiatives that are controllable by us, we can at least have something on the radar that says the collective achievement of all these other five goals that we've set ourselves, is there an indication that they are achieving the ultimate objective? Now, going back to the basics, and I'm sure the AG will elaborate on this when he presents the audit directive. Between ourselves and the auditee, there's a very clear line of responsibility that is articulated in the role of a chief financial officer and an executive authority in a department. It may well happen on any day towards or immediately after the financial year end that the chief financial officer of a department or an entity and a DG disappear from the scene for whatever reasons, and that the accountability for them to produce, at the first instance, a set of financial statements that can be relied upon could be compromised. Now, as auditors, we certainly do not have control over how long those CFOs and how long those DGs and DDGs are going to stay in the department, for example. So if we put a measure in our strategic plan that says we want to be measured on 60% outcome of the audit, we have no control over the people who are leading that process in the department. They may leave tomorrow, they may leave for the better part of the financial year. And there's another reality that there are some significant vacancies in some entities and departments, which as auditors we have no control over. So I think it would be a contradiction then to position this achievement of ultimate audit outcomes as a matter that we need to be measured on. Because if we are going to be measured on it, then it will be assumed that we can control it. But in this instance, we can't control it. We're putting it here on the radar so that as we go forward over the years, we can be able to say, all of these things that are controllable, what are they translating to in terms of results? And that's what we're putting it in there to indicate. Now, surely when we do audit, we also want to say that if we were to put this as a measure, this is another argument that we try to position for ourselves. If we were to be measured on this, and we task all our business executives in all our audit units, when they go out to do the audit, obviously they do an audit with a sense of professional skepticism. Everything that they see in the book will only be confirmed that it is a true state of affairs after they've examined the evidence. So once they go through the evidence and they find, and they have to apply their judgment to arrive at a conclusion on an audit, this might put them in a dilemma because on the one hand, they've got to present a report on the fair presentation of the financial statements. But on the other hand, they're also expected to be measured on 60% of these outcomes. So it might cloud their judgment in essence because what they are basically saying is that here is the audit outcome, but I also have a vested interest in this outcome because I'm going to be measured for purposes of my performance and my progression in the organization on what percentage audit outcomes I get. Now, let's say that they do all of this internally as honestly as they can, but let's also bring into perspective the issue of independence. That independence is judged on the basis of fact, and whether people perceive the person to be independent. Now, if an outsider knows that I am the business executive in Limpopo, I sign off audit reports which are delegated to me by the Auditor General, but in order for me to grow in my position, I also have a target to achieve 60% clean audits, and I'm specifically being measured on that. A third party might turn around and say, but you may have overlooked certain things in your accumulation of evidence, and therefore you probably applied judgment that is biased towards your own interest of achieving 60% clean audits. So that's the issue. So we're putting this on the radar here so that on an ongoing basis, we can look at it and say, are we going in the right direction? But certainly we are not proposing that this must be a measure, because you can't control it, as well as it is a dicey area to operate it when it comes to our role as independent gatekeepers that provide an independent opinion on the outcomes of activities of members of the administration. So that's in essence what that is about. We don't want to remove it, and of course we may be convinced too, but I think the point is we just want to make sure that we've got something that we are tracking over time, so that we don't veer off and one day find ourselves doing all these other five initiatives. But when we start looking at the overall impact, we probably are only getting 20% achievement, and we haven't been tracking it over time. So that's really the point.
I think my view is that this is a critical issue. In fact, it's a central matter. But I think where the problem lies is that we need to locate it in its proper context and its proper location. I don't think that the matter resides in the AG's set of achievable goals per se, as in goals that are AG-specific. I think it is a goal that, or vision, that is to be served for the sector as a whole, in the sense that all of us who have a role to play in this sector, in this environment, should collectively, or through our collective effort, have that as the ultimate vision. And in that context, then it begins to make sense. And what do I mean by this? The AG, through exposing whatever the audit outcomes expose, obviously somebody gets the pinch somewhere. And as they react to that, all right, they start doing things differently so that they don't go through the same experience again. All right? But it doesn't end there. Whoever must take action following the revelation of the audit outcomes, if they themselves take action, and somebody feels that there's a pain to doing things incorrectly, all right? Now, this is another role player. Could be an executive functionary. That also adds to us achieving that goal. If we as Parliament do our bit in making sure that we don't leave issues that are uncovered through audit outcomes, that we take action through SCOPA, through whatever other means, it adds to that. So I'm just saying it is a common vision, if you like, to all of us as role players in the overall environment. And as long as in the way in which you present it here, you contextualize it in that manner, then there won't be contradiction. Then you don't have to battle with it. So it's a question of how do you present it more than whether, in fact, you need to mention it or not. Because you are a party, you are a role player, you are a contributory element to the ultimate achievement of that goal. But you are not the sole key stakeholder in achieving realization of that vision. So it's just a matter of how do we then ensure that the way we capture it in our documents, we reflect it as the broader, collectively shared vision of goal. All right, you can proceed.
Thank you, Chair, for that.
I don't know if my colleagues agree with my sentiments or would want to see it differently. But you can decide how you then handle it going forward.
Thanks, Chair. And I think just maybe to build an element to your suggestion, we've seen in the presentations of the budgets that happened around July, August, most departments mentioning the issue of achieving clean audits. Maybe it'll probably come through those elements as well, because when they engaged the portfolio committees on their plans for the next cycle, they almost without exception touched on this issue.
And perhaps I think it's also already got a home, because I think that message has basically filtered into that environment. And I think other structures that we engage with are probably doing the same. We've seen it in provinces and in departments. So maybe the point is, maybe how does that then get given the right level of focus across the system, so that each of the role players in the system have articulated clearly what they will be working towards in respect of this goal.
I should also just conclude by saying that I think that the word influence is appropriate, because you're not really determining it, but through your actions, you're contributing towards it. So in a sense, you can claim to have some influence in it. The only issue is whether you should then set it as a target with, that then you get measured on the basis of, which is a separate matter. I think it can be taken further at the collective level when we discuss in a broader, like at an APEC meeting or something like that.
Should I just understand what the expectation is? Do you want us to come back on this issue, or do you want it further clarified? Because the position that, based on what Kim has said and what has also been raised, there's an observation that this can't be put here in this manner without any further qualifications, and perhaps the clarity of what kind of qualifications need to be put in here to clarify the context with which this matter is reflected in this document. Because at the moment, the issue that the DAG has highlighted, and in the context in which that has been put, the qualification that has been put on our side here is the fact that, and Kim, I hope that's what you're saying, although we didn't, I wanted to talk specifics. The weighting that is allocated to this is minuscule in relation to the cautionaries that the DAG has put. And on our side, the qualification, therefore, would be the fact that that 15% weighting is a cautionary that has been put. I mean, this thing is not measured over, for instance, it's not given 60% or 80% or 30% weighting. It's given a weighting that we believe would be appropriate to still make it meaningful and make it serious and make it an issue that does need to be taken care of. But there are other qualifications that were suggested to be required to be reflected here by the Honorable George. And perhaps if we can just brainstorm around those, so that ultimately the issue is whether, if we leave it here, under what condition does it get left, or if it's taken, if it's not left here, or if it does not need to be here, then it gets taken out. Otherwise, it's going to give rise to some measure of confusion. So we're coming here with a position that we have got our own qualification to respond to the sensitivity that the DAG has referred to. I'm trying to move away from an ambiguous and indecisive position on this matter, because it is a very vital issue that gives meaning to our role as a Chapter 9 institution.
Let me tell you what my understanding of the weighting and the context of the weighting would be. If it depended solely on the AG's intervention that we achieve clean audit, in other words, it was not a matter that in part relates to what auditees do or do not do, members or parliaments or legislatures do or do not do, executives do or do not do, then I would say the responsibility lies 100% or squarely on the AG's performance. But because it is a shared vision, goal, responsibility, and different role players play their bit in different ways to achieve that overall outcome, which is the ultimate objective of the whole exercise. It is important, first of all, to be there, because if it's not there, why? What the fuss? What is it all about? What? Why all the effort? What is it intended to achieve ultimately? So that's the significance of it being there in the first place. The weighting should then be based on, I think, to what extent does the achieving that goal constitute what portion of the overall total number of things that need to be achieved? What portion of that total number of things that need to be achieved by the AG does it represent? And I think the very fact that it's not dependent on the AG alone to achieve means that the weighting has to be modest. And that's what I thought you're trying to get at in your motivation, to say the 15% in part relates or explains this point as well, apart from it being significant, if not the most significant objective, your ability to influence it is also limited. So because of the limitation, you lower the rating. So it's an interplay between the two considerations that then leaves you with a particular rating for that item, if you like. So in conclusion, I would say, obviously you've given thought to it to arrive at the 15%. On the face of it, I don't see why we should put it at 10 or put it at 50 because of the considerations that we had. I think if we arrived at 15, unless there's specific reasons why we should shift it from 15, that's an appropriate place to locate it. That's how I would approach it. In other words, I would say I support it standing where it is in the light of the engagement that we've just had. I don't know if other colleagues want to suggest differently or argue differently. Prof, you are a professor.
Chair, yes.
You deal with measurements and things.
Yes, chair, if you were my student, I would give you cum laude.
All right, so you agree with me. All right, Honorable Steele, you still want to have another bite of it? Dr. George?
Thank you, Chair. I think our view is that this objective doesn't belong here.
Right.
And that I think it is the ultimate, you know, there's an ultimate outcome, you want to build public confidence, etc. But, you know, influence, it's very nebulous, you know. I don't think you can actually measure it effectively. And so, you know, our view would be that maybe you could add something, you know, what would it be? Qualitative to say that you this is what you'd like to achieve and this is what you're doing, but I don't think you can measure it.
So what specifically
we think
you
should go
ambiguous in the end?
You think it should go?
So you're saying it should simply go?
Yes, Chair.
All right. Honorable Sever, did you want to comment on this one? Are you covered?
Your statement, I don't think it must go. I think your explanation was and logic is I don't think it must go. Yeah, it is well contained where it is now.
Yes.
It's well located, in fact. Even after the AG the last interpretation of his own view on the result further.
Yes.
Yeah. Maybe if one of our members can say, maybe there's a spice that needed to be added on it. Maybe.
Yeah.
But to remove it out of there,
yeah. I think if you take the views of the Aegis office and combine it with that of seemingly majority of the members, by majority vote, it would stay. And all that we would be looking at is whether there is any further improvement on it in terms of the way in which it's formulated, the way where it is located, whether it needs to be contextualized by way of a note. My understanding is that when you write budgets and those instruments, you usually have something called notes, and maybe that would be a way to clarify so that the context is properly understood. I don't know. Maybe you could use some too. But my impression is that the overwhelming feeling is that if we leave it out completely, then we render the entire exercise to be devoid of any any meaning really, auditing for one thing. Honorable, still you still want to come back to us?
Yeah, I'm trying to suggest a qualitative but yet still meaningful way of expressing. My problem remains with the actual determination of figures for these targets, because I think that is where it becomes inappropriate to actually put a number value to what is essentially a qualitative process. And I would suggest that rather than having numbers, if you're going to retain that whole line, I would suggest simply a wording like to achieve a steady increase year on year in the proportion of clean audits. So that there is a sense in which it can be measured by looking at an increase, a percentage over time, but to actually put a number to it more than that, I think, is quite simply, you know, we would be conning ourselves as well as the public.
You seem to be suggesting two different things. One is a refinement of the language used, and two, proposal of the removal of a weighting, a number weighting, percentage weighting.
So, if I can clarify, I'm only talking about the numbers under the targets 2010 to 2013. I'm not talking about changing the 15% weighting, but only the three numbers at the end. That, I think, is where the problem lies.
I see. Yes, Honorable Zana.
I propose that for the sake of progress.
Yes.
I think the ages of this year.
Yes.
They've been listening to all this input.
Yes.
And I don't think we're going to finalize or give our recommendations here today.
Yes.
Why don't you give them time? So next time when they come, then they've made it sure that they've tried to capture what the Honorable is saying in a way.
Yeah.
Because generally we agree that we leave it there, but find any way to accommodate other comrades. Sorry, Ezra, as I remember his saying, he no longer has a problem with the 15%.
Yeah.
And the problem that is there is
or the fact of him being
mentioned. The problem that he has now
is we've now shifted to the last three columns.
By the authors themselves.
All right. But I consider it progress, actually. I mean, we have moved from being stuck on the first column right to the last three columns, so that's progress. Professor Ndavenda?
Thanks. Without being overcritical, I have to comment that my research experience has taught me one thing, that you can always make projections in terms of numbers. So with respect, I see nothing wrong with numbers.
Look, maybe we'll allow them just to clarify the last three columns to conclude the matter. What is thought to be achieved by mentioning those weightings there,
because I think as far as the rest of the columns, there seems to be agreement. I'm not sure whether we really want to go into a discussion about the semantics, because different people may come with different suggestions in terms of formulation. But I think the essence of it seems to be consensus, unless the Aegis office can offer something better than what they already have. But to me, it's not really a critical issue at this stage. So if you want to clarify the three columns, you can. But other than that, I think the general principle is agreed. And that's the basis on which we'll proceed. KG, you wanted to say something?
Thanks, Chair. What I was going to say was that we perhaps need to provide more motivation on this context and why this particular line is here. But it would be useful for us to, because I mean, Honorable George did cite some conditions that need to be attached to this, and I think it would be useful to tap in your brain in terms of what you had in mind, because that is something that could help to have specific riders to all these. Not the Deputy AG has put some of the riders here as well, so that it's not something that when it's looked at by someone else, they start from a position of skepticism. So that could respond to that skepticism by the manner by which we clarify the motivation around this. And also on the numbers, if I can just deal with the numbers issue, Chair.
All right.
It's a question of also motivating why and how we arrived at these numbers, so
yes,
that they're not just thumbs up.
Yes.
Yeah. So for the next judgment, we need to have that motivation, which why would be deemed to be reasonable. Obviously, with the riders that would have been put here,
yeah.
The DAG has cited some, and perhaps we can get some ideas from the members as well.
Yeah. I had made a suggestion that what you could have is notes to it, where in the notes you then spell out the context and how far this goes, what it all means. But yeah, as far as the three columns is concerned, personally I would say I don't know what informs your optimism that by 2013 you could have clean audits right across the spectrum. I don't know how many countries are there in the world can boast of having clean audits throughout the entities, public entities in their public sector. I think that sounds a bit too utopic in my view. But maybe there's a particular context that you want to provide in your notes. Honorable George.
Thank you, Chairperson. We will sway to the majority view regarding to keep it in here. But certainly, at the end of the day, why is this being done? It's a scorecard, and it will be published, and it will be looked at and commented on, etc. And let's just say, if you take the worst-case scenario, let's just say the Auditor General has done lots of stuff. They've tried to influence and they've done all sorts of things, but the result is zero, for example. I hope it won't be the case, but let's just say worst case scenario. Nobody got a clean audit, but certain things have happened. Obviously, then your score is zero on the weighting, not so, which will then pull down the score. And then if you're looking at public confidence and you're looking at, you know, because that's what it's for, it's the objective here, the description, I mean,
yes,
you
yes.
know, it's to build public confidence.
Yes.
So that is what the result will be. So I think in the rider or the note that is put there, it must be very, very clear. Because when the reader reads this, and we might be gone by then, I don't know, they need to understand that that's what it really means. Because if I read this, if you've got a score of zero, I think, good gracious, you know, it actually is a number, and it's there, and it's influencing the total. So I think that's just the point that we're trying to make, that you don't want to actually look.
Now, I don't think you need to belabor it further. You've made your point.
Okay.
Your point
Thank
is
you.
Clear.
Thank you.
And in fact, the simple response to your point is that, yes, that's precisely what we want to happen. Because as a country, as a democracy, we must be measured in terms of how we perform on some of these issues. We've put institutions in our constitution, in government, and everywhere else to achieve these noble goals of a democratic society. And if we fail as a collective, we all must take responsibility, including the DA, including the opposition. You can't say, well, we were not in the governing seat, so we're not in to blame at all, because you have a specific role to play. You are also watchdogs. You have to, that's why you ask this not-so-sweetheart questions like us. We all have a collective responsibility to make sure that democracy works for the people. Now, the AG can't come and say, well, all I had to do was to report to Parliament, and that's as far as my mandate went. So if people didn't act, don't look at me, look at them. The people must look at all of us. So I don't think it's a bad thing for them to say, we take collective responsibility with the rest of those that are in a position to influence this thing. I think that is the context that is presented. And I think it's a noble sentiment. It shows that all of us are prepared to take responsibility to make sure that this democracy works ultimately for the people. You know, when people go to a parliamentary constituency office or to a councillor or to a member of parliament, they don't ask whether the issue they're going to raise falls within local government or national government. They say, you are the government, and I don't get my grant. They'll go to the AG's office and say, they are refusing to pay my grant. The AG can say, all I do is report. People don't relate to government in that manner. So that is how we should also approach this thing, to say, we are in this boat together. If it sinks, none of us survive. You see? So whatever it is that we can do to keep the boat afloat, let's do it. I think it's a very positive and a very good approach. So if the rating goes down, even if it's on the basis that they had done their work but somebody else failed to do it, as long as they didn't put the rating too high on that point because it's a shared responsibility, I think they're already covered thereby. They shouldn't get the 100% even when the overall picture in the country is that compliance is declining, you know. That should reflect in the rating of all institutions that have a role to play to see to it that the overall vision is achieved. I think it's a noble objective. I like it, actually. All right. In fact, even the DA rating should go down because it means you haven't played your role effectively either. Because if you had, even if you could not hold disciplinary actions against those officials, but somehow your role, wherever you play it, should have some influence. If it doesn't, then it means you're not doing what you're supposed to do effectively, and your rating must go down as well. All right, so that's the context, and it will just be captured properly in the notes so that whoever reads it understands the context in which this is being said. All right. Can we proceed on that note, on that progress?
Recommendations on actions to be taken. Under the first page, Honorable Sebe, we are referring here to the audit recommendations that we make in our audit report and the actions that those that are charged with executing the administrative responsibilities in the department would need to be driving. So it's those recommendations that we're referring to. I know that you mentioned something along the lines of people doing business with government. I think that's all the issue around conflict of interest. I wasn't sure. But here, to clarify, it is more around when we pick up weaknesses in the processing of financial transactions, the recommendations that we make sometimes do not get actioned. So we are trying to focus on that in terms of that.
It's supposed to be recorded, so you must be as close as possible to your mic.
Okay, thank you. I was saying, on those recommendations, I understood, and I also understand what you're saying now. But what I was checking, so I can give you an example, with other portfolio committees. Maybe that is why I wanted to know your own view in that regard of the public service, without disclosing their business interests. I was checking that maybe you identify those weaknesses and you recommend actions to be taken. That's what you are saying. I'm saying those weaknesses, is the MSA and the PMSA not part of it? Or are you saying, are you confirming that there is still a best tool for the government, for the civil servant? There are no weaknesses that made to the civil servants not doing their work or some of your own findings. It is not playing any role. I can give you an example. If you talk to ICASA about the internet connection, it's part of their performance, but they'll hide behind Chapter 9 and not into a competition and training commission. That in a way, part of the thing that doesn't allow them to do their work. In a way, they also refer you to the same PFMA that they cannot perform. So I'm saying, in your findings, if you say, maybe for example, in this municipality, the CFO is not able to perform, maybe he doesn't have skills or proper qualifications, or is the understanding of himself around the CFMA itself, or they're just not implementing it. Because in municipalities, most of the issues, it might not be written down as our own simple understanding. The most problems of the municipalities for this poor, for the qualified audit is because of their interest. They are not just performing because of their interest. They have the interest in the same municipalities. They are doing business in the same municipalities. When they do this report, they do their own thing. Sometimes it's not a matter of capacity. If they're always returning to capacity. So I'm saying, simple question is that, do you think the PSM by saying civil servants must declare their interest, is it enough? Or do we have to say they must not have it at all? They must not have interest at all. Declare or don't have interest at all. That's what I was trying to say. Your own thinking.
Do not have conflict of interest at all.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I'm not sure whether you got the context and so on, but can you just... Yes, the IG...
Yeah, I think on this one, Chair, we always move from the position that we, on our side, don't question the logic of the authors of the legislation or policy. Our role is always about whether that policy or regulation is implemented. Because once we get to the territory where we then question the adequacy of that policy or legislation, then we get into a territory that doesn't belong to us. We can provide incidents that are causing difficulty or deviation from that particular policy, and for the legislatures and the leadership to then make a decision as to the appropriateness thereof. But we will not be in a position, otherwise we'll be conflicted, to criticize the relevance or otherwise of a state legislation or policy.
My understanding is that, in fact, if you look at the report which you introduced towards the end of the last parliament, which was taken up right at the beginning of this parliament, which relates to the matter that Honorable Tsewe is talking to, namely the holding of financial interests by public servants. In fact, it was more specific, it was trading by public servants with the state through using their own external procurement entities to do business with government. In some instances, with the same departments that employ them, and obviously a clear and direct conflict of interest. That report, in fact, talked to both aspects that she's touching on. One, revealing non-disclosure as per the requirement of existing policy and legislation, but two, pointing to an actual conflict of interest even where disclosure has occurred or did not occur, between what the officials have been doing and what they are allowed to do or not do. So the issue was not even about, if I understood it correctly, there may have been a separate issue of the adequacy of the legislation and policy, but there was a simple factual situation of saying, even with the current framework, transgressions have in fact occurred for which corrective action is due. So that's how I would have read the situation. And in fact, your general audit report, one of the things that it does is to uncover similar practices where you are able to uncover them. Now, that's how I understand it's already in fact happening. Now the question may be whether Honorable Tsewe is questioning the adequacy of the process of uncovering through your auditing activity. I would have thought that would have been answered by an earlier response to an earlier question where you talked about the distinction between general reports and forensic reports. That where you have reason to suspect that something fishy has happened, you are then able to come back and do a much more intense drill-down investigation, which would be of the kind called a forensic. The only thing that maybe I need further clarity is how the whole discussion would then link to a specific issue on this document, which is where I think we just need to get clarity to take us forward. Sorry? All right, Honorable Steve first, and then we'll come to the DAG for the response. Yes, Honorable Steve?
Chair, the SCOPA report on the conflict of interest is currently lying before Parliament and will be debated in the next 2 weeks, and essentially makes recommendations to address disclosure, permission, and prohibition, all of which we are asking the Public Service Commission to investigate with a view to possible changes in the legislative requirements. So I think all of those issues are addressed in those recommendations, but essentially it's up to the PSC to now review all of those three areas within the legislation. So I think that matter is being dealt with.
So essentially we can defer the whole matter to that particular process, which obviously will then resolve whatever shortcomings in the system and clarify whether there's any further things that the AG's office in their auditing would need to then drill down into to give full effect to that process. DAG, do you still want to come?
Yes, Chair. Chair, if I understood Honorable Tsewe's question in relation to the issue, the reports that we issue, and what then happens after a recommendation has been made and there is no action. If I look at the PFMA in Chapter 10, Section 81 that deals with financial misconduct. Among others, it says that an accounting officer for a department or a constitutional institution commits an act of financial misconduct if that accounting officer willfully or negligently fails to comply with the requirement of the sections listed. But the one section which I picked on was Section 38, among others, which also, Section 38, requires an accounting officer to put in place a system where there is fair, transparent, and equitable procurement of goods and services. Now, clearly, among other things, the issue of the procurement process that gives rise to the conflict of interest issues that are contained in that report, if one looks at Section 38 of the PSMA, it deals with those issues. So I think a lot of the stuff that Honorable Sarah is raising is contained within the PSMA, among others, in terms of what has to happen in law. I think the question then becomes the application of those provisions of the law in the event that the report is tabled, because the findings of the office will continue to be the same findings for as long as there's nothing done in the context of what is provided for in the law. So, and I look at Section 38, which deals with general responsibilities of accounting officers. Among others, it says that they must maintain an effective, efficient, and transparent system of financial control, and also must make sure that the provisioning of goods and services is fair, equitable, transparent, and competitive. That talks directly to, among others, what then happens to a conflict of interest report once it has been tabled. So there's enough in the law here in terms of the PSMA that covers those issues.
Of course, the further step there is that even if a finding is made that controls were not maintained, that does not necessarily mean the end of the story. Because as a consequence of that, actual fraudulent transactions may have happened and not be clearly documented or exposed or revealed simply because the financial controls, you know, there was no proper keeping of records and so on to allow a transparency as to what actually happened. But if you reconstruct the case, you may find that, in fact, it leads you to some money ending up in somebody's pocket wrongly, whether an official or somebody else with an interest. Honorable Sede?
Honorable Chair, I think yourself and Honorable Sede here didn't understand my question, but maybe
right.
The DAG has correctly captured
correct.
My understanding. I was not thinking about the rest of the issues you are referring to.
All right.
Exactly those and the other things that the AG has said, I think he has answered me to say they are not in a place to criticize legislation. Because I was speaking on the issues raised by the Deputy AG on the PSMA, the act that has been quoting. My question was simple, not these other issues. My question was simple that those acts are there. Those are the tools to guard against all these other things.
All
right. I just wanted to know from the other side
that
are these tools still relevant today? And I'm saying, I think I'm covered by AG and the deputy.
All
now,
right.
The members of parliament, you are taking it too far. I was not yet there.
Well, obviously, we have an interest in the other issue.
Okay.
And I think we're entitled to discuss them. It's fine for you to get your answers to the questions that you raise. But if those questions trigger further issues that the committee has an interest in, we're perfectly entitled to drill deeper. As long as in the process we do not prevent you from getting the answer to the question that you want an answer for, that's also critical. But we're not confined to what you have specifically asked as a committee. All right? And in any case, as a committee, we're not even confined to what is purely, strictly speaking, our mandate. We're a committee of parliament, so we're part of the institution of parliament. If we find issues that impact elsewhere in the overall institution and overall democracy, we shouldn't shy away from engaging with those issues. I serve in many other forums. I'm in the rules committee, I mean, this and the other thing, where some of these issues have to be taken forward. And your advice as a committee can assist the institution in terms of institutional reform as well. So let's not unnecessarily limit ourselves when we engage with these issues. Ultimately, the interest of the people is what must guide us. All right. Are there any other questions that were asked that were not responded to? Yes, I'll give it to you.
Let's call the number still, Chair. Just another one on the debt recovery plan. The answer is yes, we do have a debt recovery plan. I think the issue that we are sitting with now is the fact that that debt recovery plan that we have in place does not always translate into cash in the bank. That's the only challenge that we have. So we're trying to find a way to nudge more and more on this recovery plan so that at least the cash can come off the debtor's ledger and sit in the bank account. So that's really the key challenge now. But we have embarked on this route by actually applying our persuasive tactics, if I may say. We still think that that's probably the workable approach to the debt recovery plan. Otherwise, the last option, we think that it may not be sustainable. The last option in terms of the debt recovery plan then is to use the law to take those that owe us the money to the courts, and we don't think that it's a viable alternative. On leading by example, Honorable Prof. Nabandaba raised the issue around what are the measures that we follow. There was an interesting suggestion that we got from one of the DGs not long ago when we went around on the PFMA debrief. And we're actually talking about this issue of lead by example. And one of the suggestions that was made by this DG was, why don't you invite all the accounting officers to your SCOWEC meeting when you present your annual report as an office, so that those people who have got accounting officer responsibilities, when we present and hopefully our report will be clean when we present it for all time's sake, but when we present it as DGs and accounting officers, they can be able to take the cue among others on the things that we focus on how we focus on, so that they, as people that we audit, can also learn from, among others, the things that we do, so that this lead by example is really put into practice, because they'll sit in the meeting and hear out how things are done differently in this institution, so they can be able to look at whether they are relevant for implementation in their own environments. So we haven't taken up that suggestion because we obviously had a challenge with the firming up of the date and all of that for this year, but certainly in the future we will consider that as, among others, one of the measures to broaden the scope of influence that we might have in the system where we audit.
In fact, one of the ways to do it is, instead of coming here and just be observers of how you do things, we could look at a collective initiative between ourselves and other relevant committees, where we call them to come and explain to us not so much detail of what's contained in the public accounts, which is the role of SCOPA, but just to ask one simple question. Why do you continue to have qualified audits? Can you tell us? Lay a red carpet for all of them. Especially for those that are perpetual culprits. Just tell us why, What is it that makes you not to change despite so many attempts to correct you, But those are things that relate to the broader debate about transformation of parliament. There is another matter, by the way, which I'm busy discussing with different people in Parliament to look at, and that is, how can we elevate the tabling of the general report of the Editor General into an event in Parliament, in the same way as the budget, the tabling of the budget by the Minister of Finance becomes an event. Because maybe that's another way, and this is also in response to the other matter where there was confusion or different perspectives about the relationship between Parliament and the AG when it comes to reporting to Parliament, where the AG's view was that it's not up to the AG to drag down transgressors on a public platform, that is a political function that should be performed by those who are charged with the oversight function, such as ourselves. And others felt strongly that when the AG make a public statement, presents a report, he must actually name and shame those that are responsible. So it's a matter that we're still trying to process and see institutionally. How do we resolve it? I think it was at the level of the chairs that the matter was, but I think institutionally we may need to resolve. The other issue that I wanted to raise in relation to clean audit, now that the ultimate objective is to achieve clean audit. I was brought to, it was brought to my attention in my constituency that I'm deployed in Sebokeng. But there is a specific situation where there has been recurring qualified reports because of things that were beyond the control of an auditee. Like, for example, a transaction that relates to the transitional process back to 1994, which remain on the books unresolved year on year. 15 years down the line, it's a recurring issue that possibly need legislation to intervene and resolve. But as long as the issue is not resolved, that entity will continue to show on their books an unresolved issue, and therefore the audit will continue to be a qualified audit. I don't know if you want to comment about generally about such situations and what is happening between yourself and Treasury to find another way so that people do not have their name tarnished for things that are beyond their control. That when we read qualified, we must understand it to mean qualified in the sense that the incumbent, the current situation is what we're dealing with. I don't know if you want to comment on that.
Yes, sure. We have dealt with that issue 2 years ago because in the municipal road shows 2 years ago, I mean, that was an issue that was prevalent right across the country. And on that year, we did say that we need to escalate the role of Treasury in prescribing an accounting solution to those issues. And many municipalities have done that. And the ones that haven't done it, it means they haven't approached Treasury to seek assistance in terms of how to deal with it from an accounting perspective. Most of these issues don't require an introduction or a legislation or anything of that sort. It basically requires Treasury to make a specific directive on how those issues should be dealt with from an accounting point of view. And I'm surprised that there are still municipalities that are saying that, because that's the point that we've made, and all our provincial offices have been coordinating with the municipalities to create a central database of municipalities that are still affected by what we call these issues, legacy issues. So
I think we might just advise municipalities who raise those issues to actually forward specifics in writing directly to your office if they still have qualified audit based on that, if that's what they are certain, so that there is no assumption that are not actually reflective of what it actually pertains. Yes, AJ.
Chair, they should not be directing issues to us. We have indicated which route they should take. And in this respect, it comes back to the issue we keep citing, that CFOs are not doing their job. A CFO in that municipality should know what to do in relation with Treasury to find an accounting solution to the issue. And in fact propose a solution, an accounting solution to Treasury so that Treasury can function it.
Yeah. The program, as I said in the end, I would like us to reflect on the program of the committee. One of the ideas we're going to put across is that we have a briefing from the Accountant General, and maybe in that context we'll begin to hear more from Treasury's side in terms of measures that are being put in place to deal with some of these issues. All right. The one last issue that I wanted clarity on, again relating to these issues, relates to, I'm trying to remember, it just slipped my mind, I'll come back to it later. All right, I think point, we can then proceed to the next item that is going to be presented.
I think the next item is the audit directive, and this is where perhaps some of the questions that were raised by Honorable Steele last time could be responded to. If I recall them, it was an issue around, was it materiality? And there was another one which I can't quite recall now, and risk management. There is a document that would have been made available that talks about the government gazette that needs to be issued in terms of the Public Audit Act, which gazette or general notice needs to inform. That's correct, yes. It needs to inform the auditors that are carrying out audits in the public sector.
Is this the draft that needs to be published after this engagement, or is it something that's already operational?
It's a draft that's still being consulted with GOET.
So it's being presented for our comments.
It's being presented for your consideration, so that if there are any issues that...
All right.
Need to be considered for clarity's sake, we consider them.
All right.
There may still be issues here of a housekeeping nature to have to tidy it up, but if the broad principles are contained in here.
All right.
And this is what I will attempt to go through.
All right.
Yeah. Sure. The document is basically split into four parts. But maybe I can just give a background to it. This document used to be issued separately around March of each year, but we felt it did not make sense if we have another session with GOEC to consider this matter in isolation, because it ought to be part and parcel of the consideration of the audit strategic plan. And that's why we have, in fact, for the first time, moved it to this part of the season, which is together with the strategic plan. It's a document that is meant to be authoritative in terms of the standards by which the audits have got to be conducted in the public sector, and the categories under which we have processed this. Let me just restate that, Chair. The basis of these sections are also meant to not to get into the details of each and every standard that we use, but to make a reference to the standards that we will use, with the understanding that the auditors have got the ability, in fact, they've got a professional duty to study those documents. So it doesn't go into the details of each standard, but it goes to the references of which standards should we use, with understanding that those standards are properly defined, in fact, they are authoritative because they have been created and formulated by professional bodies that have got the adequate and sufficient amount of reputation. And also, there is a lot of consultation that does take place.
International or local, or both?
It's predominantly international. Predominantly international. Where there's no reference point at an international level, we have created our own local version. And I can only think of one incident instance where we've got our own internally generated guideline. But for the rest of them, they are based on the international norms, and which is an important standpoint that we need to bring to the attention of the committee. Yeah. So, and due process as a result would have been observed in arriving at these standards. That's why we're comfortable with them. But the other due process that we follow is to consult with the various technical committees that exist within the country that have got an input in most of the standards, that have got an ability to comment on the practical implementation of the standards for South Africa. So there will be also a wider consultation in terms of the technical development of this directive. Mm-hmm. And within the office, I can confidently say that every professional body that exists in the country has been given an opportunity to go through this directive. From Treasury perspective, to private sector, to public sector. So those would be the broad categories of people that would have been consulted. And also, the other issue that's important in terms of the consultation is that the approval thereof is that our own senior leadership within the office would have gone through this as well and satisfied themselves that they're indeed appropriate for the continuity of the audit approach and the audit reference that we use. So that, in a nutshell, the background in terms of the process that we follow to arrive at this particular document. Now, the four sections that relate to this.
Maybe you can also just clarify whether the auditees have any role in that process. I'm asking the question cautiously because obviously if you are the person who's to be audited, you can't say, I'm going to lay the rules on which you're going to audit me. It should be the auditor that lays the rules on they're going to audit you. But is there any form of is there any interaction whatsoever on the side of the potential or actual auditees?
Yes, Chair, the auditees get consulted through our engagement with Treasury because that's the main coordinating body in government for the auditees, and Treasury and in fact the Accounting Standards Board have been taken through this particular process and this document. So we are comfortable, therefore, that would be an appropriate and objective enough stakeholder within government to engage on this matter. And they too have been fine with it. And there's a reason for consulting with Treasury on this matter, because these audit standards are going to be superimposed on the accounting framework that government introduces. And it's one of the sections here, it's Section D which I'm going to talk to. And that's why it's important that there is a link between the auditee as well as ourselves to make sure that there's no conflict between the auditing standards and the accounting framework on which these standards would be applied. Yeah. We didn't deem it necessary to consult each and every government department. That gets done as a matter of audit process, as part of the planning process and as part of the consultation with the auditee in terms of the audit planning and the audit scheduling. So the auditees will be aware of that as part of that process of implementation, not a standard setting. Yeah. Now, going through the specific key elements of the directive, before perhaps I go through the ones on the board, let me go through the four aspects that are covered in this directive. The first aspect is the fact that this directive talks about the audit function that is performed by the auditor, by the audit office in terms of the Public Audit Act. And it categorizes into the various elements. One, the evaluation of the public finance management, which essentially is the totality of what it is that we audit and what kind of conclusion do we arrive at when it comes to those issues that we've audited. And for us, I think it's important that we were clear on that aspect. And in this respect, it covers the five areas that we focus on as part of our audit focus. The first one is the audit opinion that we issue on financial information, which is where we spend 90% or so of our effort at the moment. And in that respect, the outcome that we would have been discussing as part of the roadshows formulate the essence of that bullet, the conclusions and opinions on financial information. And what we made reference to in terms of the clean audits and the audit opinions does talk to this particular bullet. And this is where perhaps we can go back to the session we had on the orientation in terms of the various categories of the audit opinion. Those opinions are informed by this particular responsibility. The other areas that we do consider is the performance information. And as far as performance information is concerned, we had intended initially to make an opinion or conclusion on that in this financial year 2009-2010. But because of the results that we have published in our analysis, and which we are discussing during the roadshows, it was very clear that it's going to be difficult to issue this particular conclusion without significant qualifications for most of the government departments, because they are far from being ready. There's a national average of about just over 40% of departments that are still not dealing with this information in a manner that is appropriate and intended by the guidelines that Treasury has issued. But as a result of that, we thought while the education is happening on the side of the auditees, we should continue to audit this information in full, but not issue an opinion on it, but rather than issue an opinion report on it as part of what we could refer to here in the report as other legal and regulatory requirements, so that it is still in the spotlight, but not necessarily issuing an opinion on it. All right. And if you recall, Chair, there are three areas that we're concerned about insofar as performance information is concerned. The extent to which departments were adhering to the regulatory framework or requirements to manage service delivery budgets. First, do they have clear strategic plans, what they're going to do with the money? Do they have an effective monitoring mechanism when they utilize the funds? And is there proper oversight over the way these funds are utilized, both from the executive side as well as from the legislative side? And there, most departments are still having shortcomings in being able to implement decent practices in terms of managing and monitoring that information. The other one is the usefulness and meaningfulness of the information. There's still shortcomings there, but the third and most concerning one is the fact that most of the information that is reported is not supported by valid evidence, therefore deeming it unreliable. So there's a lot of reporting we'll be doing around those issues while we're still deferring the issuing of an opinion in this area. The other three areas are the ones that give rise to what is covered under other matters. And you recall during the roadshows there were issues that were flagged as undermining the credibility of the control environment. And in this respect, we will still continue to report on the internal control shortcomings as under other matters. We will still continue to report on the compliance or non-compliance to legislation under other matters. And so we'll also continue to report on these issues when it comes to other matters that we deem relevant for public interest. Like, for instance, we have identified two areas this year, the controls under information systems and controls under human resources. In the future, next year, we're looking at a transversal audit on a horizontal audit on supply chain or procurement. So that's another area that will come into a specific reportable matter. And as we go forward, there may be other areas that we may deem necessary to report to confirm how strong the internal control environment is on those things that we believe to be high risk insofar as government finances are concerned. So, Chair, those are the parameters within which we then make an evaluation on public finance management within government. And based on this background, there's a section that now talks about the auditor's opinion. What is our source of reference in making these conclusions? Here we use the international standards thick book on the auditing standards that are developed by the International Federation of Accountants. And within the International Federation of Accountants, there's a specific body that is dedicated to develop the auditing standards, which is called the International Auditing and Assurance Standards Board. In South Africa, there is an equivalent body within SAICA and the regulator that will also look at these standards and make a call as to what the South African position would be on them. And gladly, or from a South African perspective, these standards are adopted as they are without any modification. So there's a clear alignment or convergence between the international standards and the South African standards. And we also, as the audit office, adopt that similar approach. So, and the auditors that are auditing in the profession, including ourselves, have got an understanding of the contents of those standards in carrying out their work. There is an additional element that is important here, is that in the public sector, even though the standards have got what is called a public sector perspective, but there are also specific standards that in TOSAI, which is now the organization, International Organization of Supreme Audit Institutions, does also have additional guidelines and standards. We do also do take those into account. And when necessary, we draw the attention of the auditors in the public sector to those standards as and when they are deemed relevant. And this applies in particular to areas that I will cover at a later stage. Chair, I might just well say here, and it's covered in the directive, that in future we will be migrating towards the InterSci standards in totality. At the moment, we're not doing that because InterSci and IFAC, which is the International Federation of Accountants, are still in the process of developing some measure of alignment and convergence between the two institutions, because IFAC is a private sector audit standard setter. InterSci is a public sector auditing standard setter. For the past, I think, 6 years, in fact 8 years now, there's been a lot of collaboration between the two bodies. And that collaboration has given rise to a lot of progress being made in putting together the standards of auditing purely from the public sector perspective. We are expecting that in 2010, next year, November, a full set of these public sector standards will be complete, and that those standards will be adopted by InterSci in Congress, which will enable us to be able to now utilize them without any hesitation. So we're just highlighting this, Chair, for the sake of bringing the committee to understand that this may be the second last year that we will be relying on the private sector standards, but in future, once InterSci has adopted the public sector standards, we'll be making reference to these standards as a basis of auditing the public sector. So that's the fundamental aspect of this directive, to say that these standards are credible and these standards are worthy of being taken seriously by all those that audit in the public sector. That's with regard to financial auditing. If I can just jump now straight into, I think, it's page 3, where it talks about other types of audits that we do, right? And which standards do we use for those? Because there's performance audits that we do, there's investigations that we do, there's the special audits that we do, and other related services that we perform. It's paragraph 14 to 17, in fact 8 to 18. That section is important because the rest of the other paragraphs above that would be covered by what I've said in terms of which standards we use. It would be the international standards on auditing, which are IFAC based and also InterSci supported.
Look, we won't use this as a platform to rewrite the standards themselves, because obviously they are internationally established and have been tried and tested and they are being applied. It would be rational for us sitting here, not being chartered accountants with all the experience that have gone into developing them, to try and improve on them. I think it would be sufficient for us to understand the background behind. But obviously later we'll talk about whether there's still other interactions that need to occur before we put our stamp to formally, you know, endorsing that. But that's hopefully, I see my committee thinning up, so we may just want to only touch on the
core issues that we need to highlight, and then go straight to the last matter of the tariff.
Yes, Chair. Paragraph 18 to 18 is important, Chair, because this is where we are using a different set of standards. And all I need to draw to the attention of the committee that for performance audits, we use here international standards that are based on INTOSAI, because INTOSAI has got very clear and very progressive guidelines for performance audits. And we have based our own guidelines on these from 14 to 18.
On the notice
itself, paragraph 14 to 18, yeah. This is where, as I indicated, there are other types of audits that we do which constitute the other 10%, because 90% is what I referred to earlier, which is financial audits. The other audits, which constitute about 10% of what we do, are covered under this section. What I was saying, for performance audits, we rely a lot on the INTOSAI standards, and our guideline in this respect is premised on those guidelines that INTOSAI has issued. For investigations, this is where there's no guideline for conducting investigations. And in this respect, we have developed our own guideline as an audit office, which we expect any institution that helps us with investigations to comply with that guideline. But the fundamental principles of developing that guideline was around the principles of audit evidence as contained in the IFAC standards. But it's just that there was nothing authoritative that talked specifically to investigations. So there is a guideline that was developed, which is in existence, which we expect whoever is conducting investigations in the public sector, especially working with us, will look into those guidelines. And by the way, all these documents will be available in our website for the auditors in the public sector to consider. There are also special audits that we may look at. Here, there are standards that are available in terms of IFAC standards that we make reference to, and their references are reflected here, Chair, right up to the auditing of donor funding. So we thought we should just bring to the committee's attention that every audit intervention that you make, there is a reference in terms of the basis that we use to carry out those audits. The important section here is Part B. Part B talks about the work that is carried out by auditors of public entities that we do not audit. And this is part of the Public Audit Act, I think it's Section 43B. So normally there's a question on which standards do auditors of the entities that you don't audit, like let's say ESCOM or SABC, follow in carrying out their audits. Here we are trying to respond to that question. And in this respect, we've provided specific guidance on that matter. And this is where, in a nutshell, we are saying that we do have a responsibility to monitor whether these auditors also follow the same guidelines that we have prescribed in terms of the directive. In the past, that specific expectation was not as explicit as it is in this particular directive. And that is why we would like to draw the committee's attention to this Section B, because it is quite direct and prescriptive as to which standards and guidelines these auditors should follow. And in a nutshell, it's saying the same standards that we follow should be followed by those auditors, and we shall monitor whether or not they do that. And to the extent that they're found to be deviating, we reserve the right to then bring them to the attention of the profession, whether it's SAICA, which is the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, or the regulator, where the matter is of such significance that it requires to be dealt with by the regulator.
Well, so that's the thing with the regulator. Is it IRBA?
IRBA, yes, the international.
Right.
The, yes. That is IRPA, yes. Which is the Independent Regulatory Board of Auditors,
I say that it is my understanding that you consult with them, as you've just mentioned, in the setting of the standards that obviously affects them. The legal concept, audi alteram partem, let the other side be heard. One of the things we'll need to look at is whether, before we adopt the standards, we should consider inviting those that do interface with yourselves in the setting of the standards, SAICA, IRBA, and the Accountant General from Treasury side, who also would be able to tell us more about accounting standard setting, which I suppose informs how bookkeeping gets done, so that when you later audit, people don't say, but we didn't know what it is we were supposed to do. So at some point we'll touch on how we deal with that issue. But yeah, please for this.
Yes, Chair, I can simply just assure you that consultation we have done on our side, all the parties that are affected by the standards in all spheres of the profession have been consulted, from the accounting side, both in the private and the public sector, from the auditing side, both in the private and the public sector. We have engaged with all the entities that are affected by the standards, including those that we have not mentioned.
Do you want to perhaps mention others? I think we have an interest to know.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Within the public sector, I think these tend not to be known. There are specific bodies that are responsible, for instance, on the accounting side, like the Accounting Standards Board, that works very closely with Treasury in developing accounting standards. There are also other institutions like the IPFA, which is another entity that is responsible for accounting practices. There's also ACCA. So all the accounting bodies that exist that have got a presence in South Africa have been engaged insofar as these standards are concerned. On the auditing side, over and above the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, there are also public sector specific bodies like SAIGA, which is South African Institute of Government Auditors. You know, so there are many other bodies that exist, which are, I would say, are operating below the radar at the moment, that are not as prominent as the high-profile brands are concerned. Yeah, so we've consulted with all of them. We've tried to list all of them there in this slide here.
I think that we would necessarily want to interact with all stakeholders who have an interest and basically rehash your exercise. I don't think it would be the purpose, but it would be more to get a feel of the sector out there and have an opportunity to have some kind of interaction. But I'm just flagging it at this stage. It's something that when we look at the program going forward, we can reflect on it as a committee.
All right. Thank you, Chair. So I think in that respect, Chair, it's important, therefore, that this Part B is looked at with that in mind, because it will have a lot more significance now for all auditors that audit anything that has got relevance to the public sector, which was not the case in the past. Yeah. Section C is also another important section, Chair, which requires auditing of entities that don't necessarily have legislation that is clear for for instance, institutions that may fall outside of the net of the PFMA or MFMA. So this is a catch-all section to say if for whatever unexplained reason there's an entity that claims not to be part of a PFMA or MFMA, how do we deal with that? All we're doing here is to make it authoritative that the fallback position will always be the PFMA or MFMA guidance. And that Treasury will then take a predominant responsibility in bringing those into the PFMA register if they were missed accidentally, so that no one can say we can't be audited on a particular basis because we're not listed in the PFMA from a technical kind of basis. Yeah. The other reason for doing this, Chair, is because the Public Audit Act has got a specific provision in this respect that if for whatever reason there's an entity that falls outside of any of the prominent legislation, we shall make a determination in this respect. So we basically taken a route of using the PFMA and MFMA as a fallback position in this respect. And the last section is also a very important section in terms of the recognition of the accounting framework over which these auditing standards will be applied. And this is important because technically, if the accounting framework is not a recognized framework that talks to general purpose reporting, which is giving information that is deemed to be useful for general purpose use, there's a particular auditing approach that you will adopt and a conclusion that you will adopt in this respect. So your opinion or your conclusion will have limitations. And that's why it's important that all the entities of the audit have got the accounting framework that is recognizable, that will make us not to have limitations on the conclusions that we reach. And in this respect, we'll split these accounting frameworks into two parts. One, the one that relates to the entities that are adopting the highest level of accounting, which is defined by or determined by the international standard setters, which once again are adopted in South Africa as they are. And those entities like direct government departments whose accounting framework is determined by Treasury using the standards that were prescribed by the Accounting Standards Board. So those are the two main distinctions that we use in terms of the accounting framework. And for both of those accounting standards, we do apply the auditing approach that will make us not to have limitations in the conclusions that we issue. The specifics will be covered in paragraph 34 right through to 50, I think it's 52, 53. So there are very few entities where we issue a limited assurance on. Most of the audit entities that we audit will have unlimited assurance on our side in terms of the conclusions that we make. And if there are any limitations, there will be limitations of non-compliance by the entities to the prescribed accounting framework, not because the nature of those entities is such that they are reporting for such special purpose that we can issue an opinion in a different manner, okay. Which I think is, to a large extent, good news that no one classifies themselves to be warranting of a special treatment in terms of the auditing treatment and conclusion. All right. There's a lot of, I suppose, technical terminology that is used here that is seeking to put that in a manner that the auditors will understand. But in essence, that's what it means. So, Chair, that in a nutshell is what the directive is about, and Section E is basically a legal technicality to give meaning to the status of this directive and also the effective date. And Section G, who should be contacted in the event of clarification. Right. So that's how we profile this directive, Chair. There's an attachment here which gives some information as to how the information, that gives guidance as to how the information relating to the public entities should be provided to us. So this is just for information, but it's information that the public entities are familiar with and would be familiar with. Yeah. So that is it, Chair, in a nutshell. Thank you very much.
And you would say that at the and the other part really essentially talk to an elaboration of what is in essence covered in those first two parts. Part C, that's where you said it's where there hasn't been specific, the legislation does not specify. But now I'm just saying you highlighted, you have placed emphasis on the Part A and Part B of the general notice. Part D would be an elaboration.
Sorry, Chair, I think Part A and B are very important, because Part A is laying a clear basis on which audit reference has got to be made by all the public sector auditors.
Mm.
That's Part A. Whether you're doing a regularity audit, whether you're doing a performance audit or investigation or what.
Mm.
That's Part A. Part B is about making a clear indication that what is contained in Part A is equally applicable to all the auditors of entities, including those that we don't audit. And something that was not as explicit as that in the past.
Yeah.
And that in the event of deviation, which we will monitor, we reserve the right to then...
Catch-all.
No. That's not a catch-all. That's
okay.
Part B. What is the catch audit in terms of making sure that every auditor is auditing in terms of these standards?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a catch audit in that respect. Yeah, but there was some matter of ambiguity in the past as to which standards the public sector or the public entity auditors should follow. We'll clarify this year.
Yeah.
And also the fact that we will monitor whether or not they're doing that. And if they deviate from that, we'll take appropriate steps to redress and address that issue. Part C is the one that is a catch-all in the event there's an entity that has been missed in any of the listings of either the PFMA or the MFMA.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that they cannot make an excuse that we are not subjected to this legislation because we've got our own legislation.
Yeah.
If that legislation is in conflict with the fundamentals of the PFMA and MFMA, then I suppose they will need to be subjected to it, yeah.
Yeah.
And then Part D is also very important because it's saying the accounting framework that these entities use should be an accounting framework that is recognizable for general purpose reporting, so that no one prescribes their own reporting framework that makes them to be treated as a special case. And in consultation with Treasury, that's the section that's important, because Treasury would then have the duty to prescribe all these accounting frameworks for both the public entities as well as government departments. On our side, we've satisfied ourselves that the majority of the entities that audit fall within an acceptable framework that is acceptable for general purpose reporting. So that's the essence of how this is put together, Chair. Yeah.
So that's the essence of your story on this item. We obviously still need to get to the last one, which is the tariff. Colleagues, do you want to comment on this? Yes, Honorable Sofio.
Thank you, Ted. In page 3, the AC said in number 15, there were no guidelines. Then you developed your own guidelines. Were those guidelines up to the same standard or level with the INTOSAC? Number two, I'd like to know with the entities not performed by the AGs, do you give the guidelines that they have to follow you? And if they don't, what then? What do you expect?
Any other colleague? I just want to check. Obviously, you are in a better position than us, because you have had an opportunity to interact with all stakeholders, got feedback from them, went back and improved on whatever needed to be improved so that you are able to present the final product in its final form for us to consider. So we don't have that advantage in the sense that we are not privy to those kind of interactions. You know, our experience, if you're coming from a portfolio committee context, is that you normally hold public hearings whenever you need to make a decision on anything. But in this context, it's different. Is there any issue that arose in the course of your interaction with various stakeholders that you would want to bring to the attention of the of SCOAT in informing us on the decision? Whether those issues were resolved or not resolved, so that we get some slight insight into the nature of those interactions.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I'll respond to this question together with the pending questions from Honorable Steele. On the guidelines for investigations, the basis that we used in developing them, which gives us comfort that they are credible, is that we were confronted with a situation where there is nothing all over the world as to the standards for conducting forensic audits. Are authoritative, and we were uncomfortable about that.
But they would be country-specific type.
They would be country-specific or firm-specific, so each firm that has got a specialism on forensic audits would have its own procedures as to how they go about doing that. But what's common amongst all of them is that they use the common logic that is contained in auditing standards of the credibility of evidence and the credibility of due process and the credibility of the final report. So everything that has got to do with the proper planning, doing a proper field work, and doing a proper reporting, and the due process that has got to be observed in all those stages is what everyone follows. But there is no document that you can say, this is a document that talks to forensic audit. all we did based on that research and that understanding was to put that principle on paper and formalize it and gave it the identity that this is what we will follow when we do investigation. Yeah. So on that basis, we're happy that they are in line with the standards that are acceptable in the field of auditing. With regard to the entities that we don't audit, in this respect, we in fact this may also touch on directly, indirectly the question that you've raised in terms of the credibility of the consultation that has been made and whether there are any issues that are still pending. On our side, with the consultation that has been made, I'm not aware of any pending issues because the people that were engaged, I had a clear appreciation of the basis of these standards or directives. It's not something that we created ourselves.
It's because they're internationally set.
That's right. We didn't create ourselves. We simply formalized something that the profession is familiar with and just reaffirmed it. The only thing that would be perhaps new or foreign to them is the need to consider the InterSci standards, because the InterSci standards are not the standards that the other auditors would be familiar with. And that's why the directive is important, to draw the attention of these auditors to some of those standards where applicable. So that would be the only issue that I would say is outstanding, but it's something that it needs to be flagged all the time. And as a basis of following up adherence to these standards, it's something that will always encourage the profession to take cognizance of. But we're also comfortable that even the international standards on auditing do have what is called a public sector perspective, which is consistent with most of the InterSci standards, except for those sections where there's a specific specialism like personal audit, which will not be covered in the other standards. But there are very few firms that do personal audits. That's a domain that is predominantly confined to the Auditor General so far. So with regard to those entities, therefore, we also believe that there has been sufficient consultation and the intended monitoring that we have prescribed here has been brought to the attention of the profession, and the intended action will take when the deviations have also been brought to the attention of the member body, which is VICA, the Institute of Chartered Accountants, under which most of these firms will subscribe as members. Now, on the earlier question of Honorable Steele, the issue then of the materiality and risk management will then fall within the ambit of these international standards on auditing. And in the manner in which we will define issues of materiality, we'll make sure that we look carefully into the standards of auditing, which require that level of materiality should be based on specific criteria, and it's not a prescribed number. It's based on the auditor's judgment on the risk of error in that particular entity, and also on the significance of the transactions that are being audited. So one will tend to pitch the level of materiality on the likelihood of the occurrence of the error. If the likelihood of the occurrence of the error because of the strength of the internal controls, you tend to, I suppose, relax that. But if the likelihood is higher, you tend to want to dig deeper and make sure that a much more minute aspects are not escaping the net. but it's all about one professional judgment. There's no exact science to it. Yeah, it's a judgment call. And I suppose a similar response around the risk assessment as well would be a... In fact, this is where it becomes even more critical, sorry, Chair.
The application of the standards, you mentioned that there would be this interaction with the audit team. Would that, for example, include the audit team raising or querying, for example, your judgment in terms of your rating of the materiality or otherwise of a particular matter? Is this the point at which the issue of weighing up becomes a process of a process where the other side gets heard and their own views get taken on board before you make a final ruling? In other words, in the mechanics thereof, of application of the standards, is that what essentially then happens?
Yes, Chair, the other party would be heard, but that hearing of the other party is about understanding the circumstances that that particular entity is, I suppose, is involved in, is associated with, so that when we finally make a determination, we take cognizance of all that information. But the decision remains that of the auditor. That decision cannot be influenced by anybody else. It's got to be the judgment of the auditor, because ultimately the decision of making a final conclusion or opinion should be an independent judgment of the auditor. Yeah, but it will take into account every information that's available in arriving at that.
Yeah.
Short of getting a joint conclusion on the materiality level, that should be the auditor's sole discretion.
Now, obviously, you're exercising a constitutional mandate in your case, which is even more authoritative than any other auditor who may be exercising a statutory authority or, you know, some similar type of authority. So, hence, you are able to bring finality with absolute certainty. In the event there is a grey line or dispute about which side the X should fall, whether this side of the fence or the other side of the fence. Just like the courts do, I suppose. Ultimately, not everybody will be happy, but once the court has ruled, that becomes the ruling. Honourable Steele?
Thank you, Chair, and I can assure you we won't pass a motion of no confidence to you in the next 5 minutes. Chair, thank you. If I could just go back to the explanation, and thank you, AG, for that. But am I correct in assuming that determination of materiality, of risk, that could change from year to year and from institution to institution? Is that a correct assumption?
Yes, indeed, it's a perfect assumption. It's a perfect assumption, yeah, because the conditions that will determine the level will be informed by all those criteria. And I'm just paraphrasing them. I mean, the standard is quite clear. But broadly, it's our assessment of the likelihood of error to occur, as well as our comfort that because of that, they are how effective the internal controls are. But also the second characteristic is the magnitude of transactions at stake. I mean, materiality for a 100 billion department will not be the same with a 100 million department. So the volume, the value of the transaction also does play a factor. But also the internal control effectiveness does play a factor as well.
Have we exhausted our question? Yes. DAG?
Thanks. So I just want to add some other elements to the whole of materiality, because it gets also broader, just to add to what the AG has said. If, for example, public works as the custodian of assets that belong to the state is being audited today, it is more than likely that the basis for determining public works materiality will be on assets, because that's really what their mandate is about. If then the mandate changes, and they are asked to sell all the assets, I'm just making a wild assumption here, I'm not saying it's going to happen, but if they are asked one day to get rid of all of those assets and be the controller of lease agreements on behalf of the state from whom the state is leasing those assets, the basis of determining materiality at public works will no longer be on assets. And that is the judgment call that an auditor will make. It will be based on rental revenue, for example, as a basis of determining at what level should the auditor be worried if the rental income generated is outside or within a particular predetermined threshold, insofar as materiality is concerned. Whereas the previous year, rental would not have mattered because they own the property. So they would have used property, because anybody who might attempt to alienate state property, the value thereof that is tolerable will be determined based on assets. I was trying to add a technical angle.
I'm going to conclude this part because time is becoming a bit of a challenge. Unless you have a very burning matter to raise there.
Yes, Chair. We didn't respond sufficiently to the issue of risk, which DAG has also touched on as part of the example of the elements that would be used to determine materiality. All we needed to say, adding to that comment, is the understanding of the business of the auditee is so fundamentally important for us as auditors in identifying what matters in that particular department. Because we can audit certain elements to death, and it will still have no relevance, really, on providing the assurance. And therefore, we need to focus on those things that really matter. And for that, we've got a duty to understand government business. Yeah. But we don't want it to be
hundreds. I assume that you're not implying that acting as the custodian of ethical behavior overall becomes something that takes the back bench, in the sense that somebody who steals fire bread, but nevertheless is a thief, If that arrives, it doesn't get trivialized as not fitting in within the definition of materiality, and therefore, I suppose when you decide whether to qualify or not to qualify, the fact that somebody stole fire rent might not even matter insofar as the entity and reporting on the entity is concerned. But I hope there's another way of being able to alert the entity if you do discover that somebody stole fire rights to make the entity aware that this person who keeps on stealing fire rights from you, and unless you identify that person and actually get rid of them, next time he'll steal 5 million rights, because it's about conduct of an individual which is risky or dangerous, which is anti-social or unethical somehow. I'm just trying to get a proper context to do that.
Your example is very important, Chair, because this is where, in determining materiality, we said one of the factors is to look at the effectiveness of internal control. Because if it's clear that most of the areas that we are expected to audit have got very weak control, then our level of tolerance will be influenced by that. But it's not in all instances where we'll go and check whether that risk of internal control did materialize or not. Because if someone is, let's say, stealing petty cash, we will highlight the fact that there are no effective controls on petty cash, but we may not necessarily spend time auditing petty cash, because whether we find an error or not on petty cash it's still not going to influence our overall conclusion anyway. But we shall raise the flag so that when one, that person that continues to steal petty cash and being a petty cashier now happens to steal 5 million rand, we shall have raised the flag that this is the control problem. And this point is very important because this is what is sometimes misunderstood in the way we report. People expect that we will report on fraud and corruption that they see every day. It's not possible to do that. But we will always report, and in all instances, we have always been accurate about identifying those conditions that would give rise to fraud and corruption happening, and alerting the leadership to the need to fix and plug those holes. So that when that fraud does occur or materialize, it can be evident that the auditors have actually pointed out a weakness in those areas. That's why we're very concerned about the weakness of reporting, the weakness of monitoring, the weakness of auditor committees and internal auditors. Because they're just a ticking time bomb for something to really cement there and get unresolved.
I really want to get to conclusion. I'll allow Honorable Steele, and then I want to round up this one.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. Just the last question. If I turn the discussion from the AG back on his own office, if I were an external auditor appointed to audit the AG's office, I would not be looking for transactions in rands and cents. I would be looking at an institution whose business is essentially around credibility, around reputation, around ethical standards. How would I set my materiality and risk then if I were actually auditing your office where your business is all about ethical standards?
Yeah. Now, materiality in this case will always be about numbers. That's what I'm referring to. But qualitative materiality is also very relevant, which is the point that you're making. And that one is seldom quantified. But it's a risk that, for instance, in our own risk assessment document, you find that is one of the risks that is high in our priority, that is image and all that stuff. We seldom quantify that, but it's always classified in terms of its rating, in terms of importance. So there's a combination between qualitative and quantitative materiality. Yeah.
All right. I think that this, obviously, for our purposes here, is to understand for purposes of approval of the standards. But this is a matter that goes beyond what we need to do as a committee, and that is the need for a proper appreciation of the audit processing out there, because if ultimately everything that we're doing relates back to the mission, which says about which talks to reputation, public perception, then clearly, you know, some of these things that could lead to misunderstanding and misconception. You know, to refer to Honorable Service example on the other occasion where, you know, there is an assertion that certain things have been done when in fact they haven't been done. You might look into the AG's office and not actually see that in explicit terms. But once you understand the auditing process and how to be able to pick up so that you can do further follow up. Then once there's broader understanding of how that whole process works, it might eliminate misperceptions of that creates the impression that maybe certain people are being shielded, or there isn't full disclosure of what is actually happening, or there isn't enough drill down to get to the bottom of issues. So I think this kind of context need not be understood at the level of SCOEC or SCOPA only, or at the level of the auditees only, but it should be information that the general public gets to fully understand, so that we all are able to read the AGE's report in context as society, as South African society. So we need to find a way of how do we popularize this, because that's the other issue that I wanted to raise. But I think this is as far as we can take this one. At this juncture, I want to pause and say, I don't know how long it takes to go through the remaining matter. We have become thin. It's to one now. There is a proposal which the committee needs to consider, and that is that we defer the part about the financial, possibly to next week, Friday, and that we can decide whether we want to approve the standards today, or alternatively just defer the decision itself for our next meeting, since we have until November anyway to make decisions on this matter, so that we decide everything collectively and not in piecemeal form, because they're all part of the strike plan. That is one matter. The other matter is, I raised an issue earlier about the possibility of inviting other stakeholders to interact with them. We accept the point that the AG mentions that they have gone through an extensive consultation. We take comfort in the fact that this is all based on international best practice, so there isn't much that you can rewrite in this book. It's all set. The practice of Parliament is to promote public participation. It might not be appropriate in this context to pursue that. But we also like to hear different role players on different issues and so on. It's our prerogative to decide whether we invite certain people to interact with, and what it is that we would want to interact with them on and for what purpose. So all of that is ideas. So I just want to check if, you know, what the views of the committee is relating to whether we should schedule a meeting next week to consider the financials, whether we should invite anybody else. That's the one issue. The last issue, so that we can deal with everything, is that the area of performance monitoring is the new area that the AG has moved into, and going forward in terms of our developing our own program, that is after we have exhausted the stress plan issue. There are other role players who play some or other role in performance monitoring and evaluation. There's a new ministry on that. Public Service Commission plays a role. The former provincial and local government ministry has embarked on a campaign for clean audits, mainly targeting municipalities and so on. I discussed with the chairs of the other committees, and they liked the idea that maybe we should have a briefing, a joint briefing session on performance monitoring as a topic, where the AG, together with other role players, would just zoom into that particular issue. Now, that's an idea that maybe week after next we could schedule our meeting on that and invite the other portfolio committees to join us. Just to highlight that specific issue because of its increased importance. But, so I'm putting it to the meeting to say maybe we need to pause here and see if we can take our business further and on which other day and what should happen next. Suggestions, Dr. George?
Thank you, Chairperson. We would prefer to actually press on if we could.
You know, we do have some time still, according to my watch. And
it's about 12:45.
Yes. And you know, if we can avoid meeting next week, I think we would appreciate that. So that is our view. If we can do the tariffs, for example, and finish what as much as we can, you know, rather than drag it on. I think it's been going for quite a while.
Right.
So if we can conclude as much as possible, I think we should do that, Chair.
All right.
Thank you.
Any further comments on the broader program as well? Honourable Steele?
Yeah, Chair. I've already received a notice for the meeting of Friday the 13th relating to a meeting with a delegation from Zimbabwe. And
yeah.
I don't know if that is confirmed, but on the strength of this notice, I have made constituency arrangements for next Friday, assuming that this would be our next meeting.
Yeah.
So I must already indicate to you that not only will I not be available next Friday, but I really believe that this is the next scheduled meeting.
Yeah. Obviously, we can't schedule a meeting for an entire morning just to meet with a delegation from a country. And it's for that reason that we thought that we could schedule a topical matter like performance monitoring. Possibly they might be keen themselves to listen to the engagements and the interactions that we'd be having with those. I'm sure they'd be more interested in seeing the committee in action as opposed to a theoretical exchange between us and them. Obviously, we could give a few minutes introduction and those kind of things, and a little bit of exchange, but really the thrust could be on that. So that is a suggestion of an actual program for the 13th in that regard. So the only outstanding issue is to decide on whether the issue of the financials gets finalized today, whether we get to make a decision on all these outstanding matters today, or whether we decide to defer. So that's your suggestion, that we finish everything today.
Honorable Sosibo.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think with the delegation, I think it's a good idea that the delegation would be with us, because even if we were planning to have that delegation alone, I don't think it will take the whole month long. It could be a matter maybe of an hour or 1.5, then we can continue with our meeting.
Yeah.
And and so they will be happy to be part of the meeting when the AG is here with his delegation. Then with finances, I think the person will have to defer it to next week, because as it is right now, I was supposed to have been left to get up first. I have visited the shuttle waiting for me and then getting late. Thank you.
Look, whichever way, the attendance is not so good at this point in time. But apart from that, our understanding is that Fridays are reserved for our meeting. Obviously, circumstances will dictate whether we proceed with a meeting on a particular Friday or not. One shouldn't be rigid about it. One also should be reasonable. I don't think the argument should be about whether a day was set aside or previously or not. I think the issue should be whether there is a need to deal with issues at a particular point in time. There has been a suggestion motivating for a Friday beyond just deferring the financial issue, and that is to say, shouldn't we also hear Treasury Audit Accountant General to interface with us on the issue of accounting standard setting, which does influence the way in which departments manage their books, which later influences whether we get the kind of audit outcomes that you then get after the fact. So I think it's a continuum, and that is a significant part of that puzzle. That's how I understand it, unless I'm missing the point. So that's the other motivation that we could have that kind of engagement. Right. I think I've heard everybody. AG, do you want to comment on any of the proposed program of the committee, because you're partners in this, not the unilateral situation from our side?
We just look at our data chair. All the Fridays in November are available for us. So if the next week is not suitable, we could look at another Friday. I think the 20th is also still available. But last time we did look at all the Fridays in November, they're all available for us.
No, I appreciate that, but I'm more asking you in terms of the content of what we propose, and if you have any comment at all in terms of the thinking that's being put forward.
You mean in terms of engaging the other stakeholders?
We're saying that for next week we could have an open day for interaction with the Accountant General, possibly bring on board brief interactions, obviously have to be brief, with a selection of other stakeholders such as SAICA and IRBA, without intending to rehash the consultation process that you've gone through, hence the word selection or selective. And that the following week we have this broader interaction with our sister role players around the issue of performance evaluation. I understand, for example, you have an MOU with Public Service Commission, and that could possibly also be presented so that we hear what is it that is in common between yourselves that this performance monitoring relates. Just want your reaction to the proposed program going forward. Yeah.
Yes, no, thanks, Jay. With regard to those specific aspects, we would be available for the session on performance information, because, or measurement or follow-up or monitoring, because that is also critically important for us. That's why we have deferred the issuing of a conclusion in terms of the directive, but rather incorporating that into some other reporting category. So if the awareness could be raised sharply with the other portfolio committees, that will help tremendously. So we would support that thought. On the engagement with the other stakeholders that we have engaged with on these matters, I think it would be prudent for us not to be part of that, so that we get an independent observation on their thoughts. Unless the intention is to position it in another manner, in that manner perhaps I can't imagine what it could be, but if it's intended to get their independent views or thoughts on this matter, I think it would be better for us, for them to feel relaxed and comfortable, not be part of that discussion. Otherwise it could jeopardize their their openness and their transparency on these issues. Yeah. That's just my thought on that one, Chair. But I would support the need to engage so that there is an understanding around the transparency with which Parliament would arrive at its own conclusions. Yeah.
All right, colleagues. Any different suggestions? Would that be the conclusion? I would assume that Honorable Steele and Honorable George may also explore an alternative if it's not possible to do things otherwise, to check whether alternates could be deployed to substitute them in the event they are unable to attend next week. Obviously, you know, you can give people a mandate in terms of which direction they should take on your behalf when it comes to the approval aspect. I think we've engaged with the issues substantially up to this point, sufficiently for you to be able to give directives to those who would be standing in your place. We just think it would be a good thing if the decision is taken until we've heard these other voices as well. And I think that's where we will leave it. Is there any other matter of urgency that anybody wants to raise? Let me just indicate that with regard to oversight visits, which was what we had hoped to also do, to visit some of the municipalities, possibly Northwest and Mpumalanga, where there have been challenges. Honorable Batella has indicated that he would want a collective approach where we don't just go alone, but other committees like finance, if they're planning similar activity, to possibly do a combined thing or something. So I still am waiting him to come back to me and finalize consultation. And as soon as we know what's possible in the program of Parliament, we'll bring it back to the committee to get your views about when and where we could possibly do the oversight level. So we're still battling with the administration around it. Once it's resolved, we'll come back to you and get it done. That would then be the essence of our way forward thus far, as far as the program of the committee is concerned. If there are no further comments, then I would want to bring the meeting to a close. I understand we no longer enjoy catering from Parliament for lunch, so pardon me for holding you this long, but hope you enjoy your weekend.